Those of you who know Dr. Wenthe, who was supposed to speak tonight, know he has not gotten better looking. I'm not him. You may tell him I said so. The topic is worship in the Old Testament. Now, it's one of the broadest concepts of the Old Testament, simply because throughout the Old Testament, there are consistent references to the worship of God's people. To somehow get a handle on the vastness of this material, what I would suggest we do is look at it in different categories. The categories I would suggest are sacred time, sacred space and sacred objects, those going together, sacred personnel, and the sacrificial system. What I'd like to do before the break is just kind of work through some of these, and then if we have time after the break, not only to discuss them a little bit further, if you so desire, but also to look at the books of Chronicles and to see exactly how perhaps we can see the Old Testament system of worship working itself out at the very close of the Old Testament era. Books of Chronicles coming at that very end of the writing of the Old Testament. Several principles might guide us as we look at these different categories. One is that worship in the Old Testament is always something which comes from above and not from below. There's a divinely mandated system of worship, a system which was not at all a haphazard thing, because it never flowed from the current interest or contemporary culture of the people. In fact, the worship of the Old Testament is always in direct contrast to the culture. A second guiding principle would be that the life and the worship of the people were one. That in the Old Testament one finds no distinction between what goes on as God's people gather in worship and what goes on in the rest of their lives. As a matter of fact, everything is ordered around the worship. The worship is not some sort of extracurricular activity that you do on the Sabbath day, perhaps. But rather, it's something which permeates everyday life. And in fact, all the things that you do are related to what goes on within the corporate worship. And the final guiding principle is that the worship of Israel was ultimately Christological. It's one of those great theological words you can throw around. Christological meaning having to do with the person of Jesus. Ultimately, the fulfillment of all things in Jesus Christ. Other categories, let's first look at sacred time. Do we have a sense of sacred time today, by the way?
Yes.
Okay, in what?
The liturgical year.
The liturgical year, exactly. There is a rhythm to the year, isn't there? In which certain things are commemorated, certain points are remembered, and which kind of call us to order our lives around things which are sacred. That is established also in the Old Testament, perhaps even a more profound way than we find it in the New Testament church. There are even calendars that are provided for us in the Old Testament. For example, in Exodus 23, several different festivals are mentioned there. This is Exodus 23, 10 through 19. The first is the seventh year sabbatical of the land. Now, what that meant was that the people were to allow the land to lie fallow for a seven-year period. I mean, for 1 year out of the seventh year out of every seven-year period, to give rest to the land. That number seven, does it correspond to anything in the people's lives? Sabbath, the seventh day. Okay, rest for the people. In the seventh year, rest for the land. And as a matter of fact, later, there is also prescribed the year of Jubilee, which is the seventh, at the end of the seventh seven-year period. Seven times seven, 49 years. And the 50th year is the year of Jubilee. That was not only for the land, but it was also to set all Hebrew slaves free, debts were canceled, all sorts of wonderful things happened. But more specifically, in terms of a what we would see as worship or liturgical concerns would be the next festival that is mandated in Exodus 23, the Sabbath. Now we find it's interesting in the command of the Sabbath that God actually gives two different reasons, one in Exodus, one in Deuteronomy, why the people are to have a Sabbath. In Exodus, the reason why the people are to have a Sabbath is because God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. In Deuteronomy, the reason is because God delivered the people from bondage. And this is to remind them of the rest that God now gives to them. Now, both those reasons are true and valid. But the seventh-day Sabbath was a sacred day, just as the sabbatical of the land, so there is a weekly sabbatical for God's people. Other festivals that are mentioned in Exodus 23 are the three feasts of unleavened bread, harvest, and ingathering. Now, what those are tied to is the cycles of the land. The Old Testament people were primarily an agrarian people. In other words, they were tied to agriculture, to farming. And so their lives would reflect the cycles of farming. You see, here God is not letting the liturgy, that is, or the liturgical life of the people, the worship of the people, somehow exist separately from the rest of their lives. But these key festivals are geared right to the rhythm of the land. For example, the harvest festival, which we know as Pentecost. Even our Christian festival of Pentecost is directly tied to the Old Testament of Pentecost. And that's because it is 50 days after the Passover. At the end of the year, which in the Middle East is actually somewhere around December 9th. It's the Hebrew month Kislev, which is the Feast of Dedication or Ingathering, the final gathering of the fruits of the earth. Leviticus 23 also provides for festivals. Festivals like Passover, the Festival of First Fruits, the Festival of Weeks again, the New Year, the Day of Atonement, the Festival of Booths. And in Deuteronomy 16, three festivals are mentioned, Passover, Festival of Weeks, and the Festival of Booths. All of these are synchronized with the agricultural cycle, so that the religious life and worship of the people is directly related to the cycles of life. That there is no separation in the Old Testament between the sacred life of the people and the secular life. So important are these festivals, as a matter of fact, that we do have in, for example, Exodus 12, a complete or fairly complete Passover ritual that the people were to follow. One of the curious things that's happening, I think, in Christian churches and Lutheran churches in recent years is something I kind of protest when I see it. You got to protest something. Are the Passover Seders that sometimes occur in Christian churches. The reason I protested is because the Passover Seder that's used, the Seder is the meal, the ritual, is actually the oldest one we have comes from about 1,000 years after Christ, from about the 10th century A.D. Now, what's troublesome about that is when we begin to think that that particular Passover Seder was somehow the same as the one Jesus used. Because historically, it just can't be shown. What's happened since the year 1000 AD with the Passover Seder is it's changed radically in that period of time. It tends to take a shape of its own depending upon where it's being used and at what time it's being used. Very, very flexible liturgy. You find current Passover Seders, which actually, the ones from the 60s are kind of bizarre. It was kind of like, you use psychedelic wine or something. Not quite that bad. But it did reflect the time of the people. Now, the question has to be raised about that. If it's that flexible after 1000 AD, what makes us think that it wasn't flexible for the first 1000 years? And yet sometimes we find Christian churches, Lutheran churches in particular, adopting about a 1,000-year-old Passover Seder and somehow crediting this and saying that this is the same as what Jesus did, when we simply can't know that. And then there's also the theological questions which come with using a Passover Seder. Was Christ the new Passover or not? Is he the final Paschal Lamb or not? And when he instituted his supper, did he or did he not give us something new? The new covenant in his blood. Important question. But we have to be careful too that we don't read into the Old Testament things that developed in what we would call Judaism. My students, anybody that's had me for a course, knows that it's a great sin in my classes to refer to the Old Testament people as Jews. Because they're not. They're Hebrews or Israelites. The term Jew is never even known until the centuries just before Christ, after the Babylonian exile. And Judaism, as we understand it today, does not begin really to develop until about the year 200 AD with the publication of Mishnah, which is a sacred book. The beginning of what we call Rabbinic Judaism. Very different thing than ancient Israel. The Hebrews. The Hebrews lived with a sense of ordered and sacred time. I think also Ecclesiastes 3 reflects the sacredness of time. If you recall, anybody that lived through the 60s, anybody want to admit that they were around like I was in the 60s? No, I know you weren't. Mrs. Just is just a mere child. Did you know she went to St. Mary's College, which is right across the street from Notre Dame, SMC? You know what they're known as? SMC chicks. Just in case you didn't know that, Linda is a SMC chick. I thought I'd help you out there. with that, I can't remember where I was at. Ecclesiastes 3, for everything there is a season. Remember that? Was it the birds, I think, sang it? Yeah. Turn. Okay, great song. Everybody loved it. Very few people knew it came from the Bible. But if you look at Ecclesiastes 3, you see that what the writer of Ecclesiastes, Koheloth, the gatherer, sometimes translate the preacher, says, he says, for everything there's a season. Begins with the big one, a time to be born, time to die. And then he lists all these polar opposites. There's a time in which to, a time to love and a time to hate. A time for peace, a time for war. A time to sow, a time to reap. A time to gather stones together, a time to cast them away. A time to dance, a time to mourn. All these polar opposites. Because see, in the ancient Hebrew mind, there was no such thing as life that could be lived apart from the presence of God. As a result, sacred time was not just something which was associated with the temple in later times, or the tabernacle prior to the temple, or the tent of meeting in the desert, but time was something that was sacred and filled the life of the people. So that everything they did was finally related back to God, to the God who had called them into being, the God who had called their father Abraham, who had called Isaac and Jacob, the God who had led them out of Egyptian bondage, who had brought them to the land of milk and honey, who had given to them all the blessings of that land. Very different than the way we think of time, isn't it? I bet if you think about your day, you'll see that time was kind of split up into different segments, most of which, if you're perfectly honest about it, weren't really connected to your relationship to God, at least in your own mind as you went through it. And yet from Ecclesiastes 3, from this whole concept of sacred time, particularly as it relates to the worship of ancient Israel, to ordering of their lives around God, there is no aspect of their life that is somehow separate from that. Sacred time becomes the first real category of worship in the Old Testament. What we don't have in the Old Testament, by the way, is a lot of liturgies. There's no Hebrew worship hymnal with Temple Service 1, first setting. There's clearly a structure to the worship. And we do have parts of that worship. For example, the Psalter, the Book of Psalms. Very much a book of worship. That's why it's so good, I think, to see it back into the worship life of the Christian church, as it has been really for 2,000 years, including the chanting of the Psalms. Because the Psalms were all originally set to music. They weren't to be spoken, they were to be sung. In fact, if you look in the Psalms, you'll see that they're in some English editions of the Old Testament, there's little Hebrew words they stick in there. And frankly, don't believe it when somebody says, well, I know exactly what all these mean. They don't know what they mean, for the most part. They are musical directions, many of them. But exactly what they meant, we don't know. But we do know is they were set to music. Those were a part of the worship, part of the gathering of God's people during sacred time. A second category, as I mentioned before, sacred space. We live in a day and age where the very idea of having space as sacred is rather foreign to the way most people think. In fact, if you look at most, or not most, but perhaps at least many new churches, that is, new buildings that have been constructed, very often they're designed as multi-purpose use, where the sanctuary is also, you know, as soon as you're done with church, you roll the altar away and you pull out the tables and have food. Okay, or the chancel becomes a place for drama or for some other activities. I know when I grew up, it was unthinkable, and I was a pastor's son, so I'd catch it at home if I tried, that you go and you climb around in the pulpit or kind of hang onto the altar, you know, and do chin-ups. You have to be a kid because you have to be kind of short to do that. I tried once, got in all sorts of trouble. Today, you see that happening all the time. And it's not necessarily just the kid's fault, because we don't live with the same sense of sacred space. Now, what's unique about the Hebrew people in the Old Testament is, while they do recognize that God, in a special way, has a place where his name dwells, we'll be talking about the temple here in a minute, a place where he has said he would meet his people, yet, unlike the other people of the ancient Near East, the Hebrew people knew that their God could not finally be confined to one place. See, to have a God who is not an idol is a very different kind of God. Your God is not made of stone or wood. Your God is not located solely in some particular place, though he does indeed promise to be there in a special way. The God of the Hebrews was one who was both transcendent and eminent. A couple more big words. He fills everything. He's all over the place. But there's no place you can go where God isn't. But at the same time, he comes into contact with human life. And he comes into contact with people. Are you familiar with the construction of the temple? Or the tabernacle, for that matter? Okay, basically, the tabernacle was designed as more of a traveling temple, kind of put it simply. It's more complicated than that, but the tabernacle could be picked up and moved as the people traveled. The temple was, once they were settled in the land, and after King David and his son Solomon finally builds the temple, it's this huge, massive, permanent structure. But there are several different areas to both the temple and the tabernacle. The most sacred is the very inner part, which is known to us as the Holy of Holies. The Holy of Holies is that place where the Ark of the Covenant was placed. Can I give you a night? This is, I lack many talents, and one of them is artistry. So you'll have to bear with me on this. Kind of a rough sketch of what the temple looks like. This very inner place is the Holy of Holies. Reason it's called the Holy of Holies, in the Hebrew language, there's no what we call superlative. Say something is the holiest place in English. Holiest is the superlative. Holier would be the comparative, and holy is just the whatchamacallit. How's that for a technical term? Okay, so what they do is they use two words in plural, make one plural. The same word repeated, make one plural. For example, the Song of Songs in Hebrew is Shir HaShirim, which means the Song of Songs. It means the best song of all. Okay, the Holy of Holies, the most holy place. And in that holy place was the Ark of the Covenant. So holy was this place that no one could go in there except for the high priest. And he could only go in once a year. And this is true both for Solomon's temple. Solomon's temple was built roughly about 950. You know, if you remember Old Testament chronology, David comes to the throne about the year 1000 BC. Solomon built the temple about 950. Anybody, seminary students, 586. What does year 586 mean to you?
Fall of
Jerusalem to?
Yeah.
To who?
To Babylon.
Babylon. Oh, these guys are so good. Okay. 586. Jerusalem falls to the Babylonians. Now, this temple had stood there for, not quite, but close to 400 years. Solomon's temple. It's often called the first temple. In 586, the Babylonians come in, they wipe out Jerusalem, and they destroy the temple. About the year 539, the Babylonians are taken over by another group of people called the Persians. In the modern-day Middle East, by the way, you know, we read about Iraq and Iran, how much they hate each other. They've been taking shots at each other again this week. Well, the Iraqis are this ancient Babylon, same area, and Iran is ancient Persia. These people have been fighting each other for 3,000 years. Yeah, and they're going to keep fighting each other. This is nothing new. But the Persians, Iranians, took over from the Babylonians, the Iraqis. And King Cyrus allows the people to return, that is the Jewish people or Hebrew people, by this time you can use the term Jew, to return back to the Promised Land. The first thing they do, as soon as they can get organized, is rebuild the temple. So somewhere between 520 and 515 BC, the temple's being rebuilt. What was needed from the perspective of the people was this sacred space. That very thing they've been deprived of, yes.
Do you know what happened to the ark?
No, it's hard. Nobody knows. In fact, that's one of the great mysteries of the Old Testament, is exactly what did happen to the ark. It certainly had been carried away, perhaps destroyed with the Babylonian destruction of the temple. But it doesn't reappear. Now, you go to the Middle East someday as an archaeologist and discover the Ark of the Covenant. Be famous, probably rich.
Like an A in class? Like an A?
Yes, you would get a retroactive A in class. Yes. We'd go back and fix your whole transcript. It'd be no problem. But everything in the Second Temple is modeled on that of the First Temple. The Second Temple is the temple that exists at the time of Jesus. Some say there's actually a Third Temple, because Herod completely remodeled the thing. And some point, you know, say that's a different temple. Now, no, it's the same temple. It was just remodeled. It's like if you have your house and you put in new plastering, it's the same house. It's not a new house. That temple, which is built, let's just use 500 as a rough year, BC, itself is destroyed in what year? 70 AD. 70 AD, approximately 40 years after the death of Jesus, the Romans come in and they wipe out the temple. Now, what do you think people in 70 AD, Jewish people in 70 AD, thought of when their temple was destroyed? What came to their mind?
Rebuilding
it. Okay, in fact, many of them, some of the literature from that time, they see it exactly as a repetition of what had happened before. Just as the Babylonians had come in and wiped them out, and they were allowed to return, rebuilt the temple. Now they look at the destruction of the temple a second time, and they think, we're going to go rebuild the temple. So about, this kind of doesn't really have a lot to do with worship in the Old Testament, it's kind of neat. There's this guy named Bar Kokhba, or Bar Kosiba. He's known by at least two different names. One meant the son of a star, and the other meant the son of a liar. It all depended on how you felt about the guy. But about 135 BC, Bar Kokhba starts this big revolt, and everybody gets all excited. And some people, rabbis, are declaring him to be the Messiah now because they think there's going to be this wonderful overthrow of Rome. And what happens is Bar Kokhba is wiped out about 135. Now you start adding these years together, and you see that one, say about 130 is roughly the same amount of time here as between here. And so they were all excited about this, but the temple is not rebuilt. What happens in Judaism at that point is they still have a sense of sacred time. Why? Because sacred time is so intimately involved, or rather sacred space, is so much a part of the history, so much a part of the theology, the religion of the Old Testament with the temple and the tabernacle, that they can't imagine existing without sacred space. Yet they don't have it, because their temple was destroyed, and the one guy, Bar Kokhba, they thought that would allow them to rebuild it, has been destroyed. That's where modern Judaism gets its roots, is out of that frustration of no longer having sacred space. I mentioned a book a while back called Mishnah, M-I-S-H-N-A-H. Maybe my spelling, yeah. My advisor used to tell me I was the only guy he knew who could misspell in five languages. So it's not an easy life, let me tell you. When he was British, so it sounded brilliant when he said it. You ever notice British people have an accent? It's a marvelous accent. Everything they say sounds brilliant. It can be idiotic, but sounds good. So they constructed a whole religious system that we know as rabbinic Judaism, that has its roots in the Old Testament, yes, and the institutions like sacred space, sacred time of the Old Testament, but it translates it and transforms it into a reflection of that with life without a temple. The synagogue becomes increasingly important. The Jewish festivals continue to be celebrated, don't they? Only in some ways, the Jewish festivals now, or in rabbinic Judaism, are celebrated almost as polar opposites or mirror reflections of the way things used to be with the temple. See, even after the temple is destroyed, anyone with roots in the Old Testament has to have sacred space. And if you can't have the sacred space, you construct a system which specifically reflects the absence of sacred space. It's not a haphazard thing. Sacred time, sacred space. Inside that sacred space are sacred objects. Things like the altar of incense, the veil, the lamp, the altars, other altars, the incense. When Judah is taken by the Babylonians and the temple destroyed in this year, one of the things that's noted in both 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, the two places where that destruction is discussed, is that the temple's objects were taken. At no point in ancient Hebrew faith were the objects in the temple invested with some sort of deity in themselves. God was not a candlestick or an altar. But those were the visible manifestations of an invisible God. The Christian church has picked this up. Not only with the sense of sacred space historically, although sadly in our day we're losing that sense of sacred space. One of the things I enjoy most about a church like St. Paul's is that there's no way you can go into that sanctuary and not treat it like sacred space. I mean, it's just this, the construction and the design, it's too awesome. I can't imagine a child wanting to do pull-ups on the altar. Boy, my father got mad about that one. Well, we've inherited the sense of sacred space. We've inherited a sense of sacred objects. For example, if you look in a sanctuary like the one next door, there are sacred objects. For example, the crucifix that's on the altar, or the statues, or the communion vessel, or the baptismal font, or the pulpit, or the lectern, the altar itself, the reredo, all the different things that are up there. Each is invested with a sacred character because they are dedicated and set apart for the service of God. When you get right down to it, the cross is metal, isn't it? All it is metal. Something dug out of the earth and refined, and by some craftsman shaped into an object which on one level is art, but on a more important level is a sacred object that shows to God's people some reality beyond their own earthly existence. The Eastern Orthodox Church has a stronger sense of the Old Testament than we do in the West. You ever heard of icons in the Old Testament or in the Eastern Church? Very difficult for Western minds to comprehend. I can't say I fully do. But for them, it is not just a matter of a piece of art, but rather the icon is a window to some greater reality. So as they meditate upon the icon, it's not the icon itself, which is either divine or salvific, but rather it is that window which it permits them to see, that greater reality beyond. For the Old Testament people, the temple with all of its appointments, and the tabernacle prior to that, remember during the desert wanderings they had the tabernacle with Solomon, the building of the temple, and later the second temple, those objects are invested with a sacred character. Sacred personnel, along with sacred time and the sacred space with the sacred objects, are what we could term sacred personnel, sacred people. In the Old Testament, they're referred to as priests. What's interesting about the priest of the Old Testament is that it was a sacred genealogy. You were born a priest by virtue of your descent. The sons of Aaron, in particular, but the broader tribe of the sons of Levi. Remember, Abraham had two kids, Isaac and Ishmael. Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau. I actually met a pair of twins named Jacob and Esau. The parents had a great sense of humor. We had a baby about a year ago. Hannah's a year old. And I wanted to name if it was a boy, I insisted I was going to name the baby Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. My wife prayed fervently for 9 months for a girl. God listened to her instead of me. So we have Hannah. Jacob and Esau, great idea. And if you ever have twins, anybody. But watch out, you don't want to stay in the same room with them as they grow up. And Jacob had how many sons?
12,
okay. This was all prior to the Egyptian bondage. Because remember, Joseph gets taken into bondage, one of his sons. The rest eventually, or it becomes great, and they all follow him into Egypt. And then after a number of centuries, the Israelites are in bondage, and there's a new Pharaoh who didn't remember Joseph, and next thing you know, it was the whole thing of Moses and the Exodus, and God leading his people out of bondage. But when they come back to the promised land, everybody gets a hunk of land. The descendants of all those 12, except for one, Levi. The Levites get no land. Why? Because they were to be the priestly family, and they were to live from the temple. Nobody else could be a priest. We have a couple of later in the history of Israel where some of the kings who are not of the house of Levi, but they're descendants of Judah, one of the brothers. The king tries to go into the temple to sacrifice something. Amaziah. And what happens to him? He goes in, sacrifices something. God says, you're not a priest, you can't do that. Staff, you got leprosy. It's great job security. Just ask Pastor Hamer. Stay away from his altar. because God had designated certain people, in this case, a genealogical thing, to serve as priests in his temple. Now, the reality is that the tribe of Levite was large enough that after a number of generations, there were too many Levites to be supported by the temple in Jerusalem. So many of them served as teachers or judges outside of Jerusalem, out in the countryside. But that gave rise to some problems later. They had to do a sacred space. Because God had designated the temple in Jerusalem to be the place where he would meet his people. The temple of Jerusalem was the place to which they were to go. But all the surrounding peoples, remember, they did not have the same concept of God. For them, God was not necessarily anything but someone which could be localized in a statue or an idol. And so the peoples of the land, and they still lived in the land, were all the time erecting their little sanctuaries. Well, the problem becomes with God's people is we want to do it like everybody else does it. And so what do they do? The Hebrews start building little altars, little sanctuaries. Everybody else is doing it. We could do it too, right? God says, no, you got the wrong idea here. And it was often the country Levites who would serve as the priest at one of these little altars. And see, that brought a sense of legitimacy to those who would worship there. If it was a Levite who did it. Because even in their even in idolatry, they had a sense of sacredness. That there was such a thing as sacred space, sacred time, and sacred personnel. Last but not least, 5 minutes before the break, I promised I'd be good and actually give you a break. And then I'm going to actually be quiet and let everybody else talk after the break, is the sacrificial system. The Old Testament provides a very specific series of sacrifices that were to be offered to God. In Leviticus 1 through 7, anybody ever read through Leviticus, by the way? I mean, actually read it? Okay, good. Most people can't get through Leviticus. There's just all these regulations, you know, called cultic regulations. You'll hear the word cultic in Old Testament studies. It's not bad like it sounds. You know, we talk about a cult today, you think of the Moonies. Okay? All a cult is worship. So the Old Testament cultists, or the cult of the Old Testament, just means the worship of the Old Testament. We're not talking about 3,000-year-old Hare Krishnas. But in Leviticus 1 through 7, during this whole cultic regulation, several offerings are mentioned. There's a burnt offering where the entire sacrifice is burnt. And there is a lamb offered each morning and evening. There is a peace or fellowship offering. It's a not a, a mandated offering, but it's a voluntary offering, and which any animal except a bird was acceptable. It was followed by a communal meal. The blood was sprinkled on the altar. The fat was burned. It was the wave offering of the thigh and breast of the animal. A peace or fellowship offering was given for three different reasons. One is for some unmerited or unexpected blessing, it's kind of a thank offering, or a payment of a vow called a votive offering, or just an expression of one's love for God, in which it's called a free will offering. Third kind of offering is a sin offering. A sin offering in Leviticus 4 is when you inadvertently committed a sin. You know, trying to get here tonight and 35 mile per hour zone, and you're going 45. You didn't really mean to do it. That comes to mind because that's what I was doing when I saw down the road, blink, blink, blink. You're stopping somebody else. But I almost had to offer a sin offering when I got here. Finally, there's a trespass or guilt offering, which is an offering given for failure to recognize God by neglecting things like giving the first fruit or tithe or other required offerings. There were other offerings that are mentioned. But the ones that are most familiar to us would be the animal offerings, the burnt offerings, the sin offering, the peace offering. Christ is called the Lamb of God. We're soon coming to the Advent season. During the second and third Sundays of Advent, the gospel reading is always about John the Baptist. See, Advent is not pre-Christmas. You know, hard to believe because you go to the mall. I never go to the mall, but my wife goes there, and she tells me that they are starting to put Christmas stuff already. And it's hard, you know, it's hard to remember that Christmas has its own character, but Advent has a character quite its own. Advent is the time for Christians to remember the coming of Christ, both not only at Bethlehem, but also in his present coming among us and in his future coming. In the second and third Sundays, we see John the Baptist. And John the Baptist, among the many other things that he said, when he sees Jesus, he says what? Behold the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. The Apostle John would write in his epistles that Christ is the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Now, that image of the Lamb is not one that was just chosen kind of haphazardly because lambs are neat-looking animals. It's chosen specifically because the sacrifice of the Lamb is one that is filled with tremendous meaning in the Old Testament. That sacred space and sacred time revolve also around the sacred sacrifices that are offered by the priests, the sacred personnel, in the name of the people. In fact, the temple in Jerusalem with the constant sacrifices going on, a rabbi friend of mine refers to it as a holy barbecue, because it would just be one animal after another with a constant slaughtering and sacrifice of animals. And the blood would be burnt, the blood would be sprinkled, the fat would be burnt. The place must have really stunk. If you've ever been to a butcher shop, it does not smell good. But that's what the temple was like. Those Old Testament sacrifices were not in and of themselves anything that brought salvation to people. All the lambs that were slain never saved anybody. But their first and foremost function was always that God's people would see before them this image of what was to come. That there was a lamb who was going to come. And that that lamb would be the sacrifice, the great and final, perfect sacrifice for the sin of the entire world. So I mean, when it's Christological. Christ is himself the sacrifice, he's the lamb, but he's also the priest who offers the sacrifice. Solomon built a temple, but Jesus said of himself, behold, a greater than the temple is here. With the coming of Christ, who enters into time, In the fullness of time, Paul says, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law. At just the right time, Paul says, Christ died for the ungodly. See, Christ comes into time. God is not bound by time. God is eternal. Time is something God created. Eternity is not time going on forever. Eternity is where time ceases to exist. But yet God sends his son into time. I always get nervous with these little mics on. I preached at one church, and it wasn't a little unit like this, but it was up in the pulpit, and it was a cord connected to the pulpit, you know, and you're supposed to clip the mic on, and I forgot it was there. And after the sermon, I turned in the pulpit, you know, you see the pastor, you know, you walk down, start walking, you know, towards the altar, and next thing I know, I hear this.